This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you again by the Friends of the Magic Word, and we appreciate each and every one of you coming back every week and listening to this, because I know there are a lot of other distractions and things to listen to and to watch, whether they're videos or podcasts or anything else that's going on, a lot of virtual lectures and virtual shows and things like that that you can always watch, or DVDs or whatever. So anyhow, thank you guys very much for coming back. And also, that since it is the holiday season, if you're thinking about wanting to purchase something for a friend, that is, you might want to drop a hint perhaps to someone who you love that might want to purchase something for you, you can go take a look over at the Magic Word Podcast store over there. We've got a few things that are my lecture items that are available, as well as some other cool things, like if you want to go through Cafe Press and get coffee cups or t-shirts or whatever like that. That always helps us here as well. So you can help us with that. And most importantly, I guess right now, everybody is buying everything on Amazon.com. And as you do, it will help us because we are an affiliate of Amazon. If you'll go to the bottom of any of the pages, just go to the MagicWordPodcast.com, scroll all the way to the bottom, and you'll see a graphic there that says we're an affiliate of Amazon.com. When you click on that, that will take you to your Amazon account. And that way, anything that you purchase through there, then a little bit of that comes back to us. So I thank you very much. It doesn't cost you anything extra. It's just something that Amazon does for its affiliates. So for every dollar that you're buying on Amazon, that we get just a few tenths of a cent for that. Not a whole lot, but it mounts up over a period of time. So anything that you can do would be helpful. And along that line, if you can also go ahead and just give us a 5-star rating on whatever podcast service that you listen to these things, I'm sure there are places where you can leave comments. And those always help us, because that helps this podcast to grow. Last week, we started a contest for 2 copies of a book by Eileen McFalls, who was my guest, author of the No Ordinary Magic paperback book, and that contest is still running this week, and so I encourage you to hurry and do that, because it will run just one more week, and then next week we're going to start another contest for some more cool stuff. It's the holiday season and the time for giving, and so we've got some really great guests and people who have offered some things, and so anyhow, you need to capitalize on that and go to the MagicWordPodcast.com, and there you will see a form this week and last week's episode number 587 and this one number 588, where you can fill out the form and put in your name and email address, and it will populate an Excel spreadsheet, which I will then randomly select next week 2 winners to get the book. So I just want to remind you to go and do that. Of course, if you get our weekly pod letter, you would know that, because I mentioned all new contests in that pod letter. So if you aren't subscribed, you can do that when you're at the website there as well. Well, this week we have another very interesting guest, and someone that I know that not only will you enjoy, but you will learn from, because he has a wealth of experience on a variety of topics, from working on college campuses, doing college shows, and then also developing haunted houses that he did for quite some time with his wife, Lori. And also he developed this character, which had taken him around the world and performing and in contests, and getting to be well known, such that he has been giving a lot of, well, like TED Talks, as well as other kinds of professional and corporate shows that he does, and then has developed, I mentioned earlier about virtual shows, he's got some other great virtual shows that he does that are available, and you ought to take a look at if you have an opportunity. And those are pretty darn cool, because he's developed a very interesting character, which he talks about towards the end of this program, and I'm going to let him tell you more about it, but he goes by the name of Richard Preston, which is his moniker for his new character. So again, he talks about development of character, and so it's certainly some good advice from someone who has been there, done that, and won awards and made money doing it. So I think you are going to really enjoy this week's episode with my friend, Mr. Stuart McDonald, here on The Magic Word. Today I have with me a wonderful guest who is from Michigan, but he could be from anywhere in the world because the world is his home. It seems like wherever he's performing, and he has performed a lot of places, including competing at FISM, and has won many awards across the United States, and has even fooled Penn and Teller. And most recently, he was thawed out. He was supposed to be performing on Mars. We're going to be talking all about that in just a moment. Please welcome my friend, Mr. Stuart McDonald. Hey there, Stuart.
Hey, hi, Scott. How are you? Thank you for having me on the show.
I'm so glad that you were able to make it, and your busy time you've been keeping really busy, I know, with a lot of different projects and everything, you know, then as well. You know, when we had first gotten together, it was so many years ago at the Magic Island, and was Lori assisting? I think she was assisting you. That's when I'd met both of you, and I'm trying to remember, was she part of your show back in, when was that, the 80s, 90s maybe?
80s, 90s, and into the 2000s, and occasionally we still do the dual act, but it's getting rarer and rarer and rarer.
And so whenever that you did perform, I can't remember, that you didn't have a dove act, it was just a two-person act. It wasn't really mind reading, but it was still comedy, I believe, back then. Is that right?
Illusions. Yeah, we did the Hindu basket, we did the modern art. Metamorphosis,
all the usual stuff,
the trifecta of magic.
Did you do the zigzag? You had to throw that in there too.
The modern art, the modern art was the zigzag.
There you go. Who built your stuff, by the way, back then?
Owen Redwine.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Owen had produced something that I was going to put in our act that was the electric light bulbs through the lady. It used to be the swords through the lady that, you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. Owen and I, we're old high school buddies.
Really?
So, yeah, I would go over to his shop all the time, and he showed me his contraptions that he was building, and I saw many of those being built.
Huh. So... Were you in? I thought he was like in Chicago, but was he in Michigan? Where was he from?
Perrysburg, Ohio.
In
just
Ohio.
South of the border.
Okay. Mm-hmm. South of, just south of
Toledo. Yes, just south of Toledo, Ohio. Where I only live maybe 30 miles from Toledo, so it was just like an hour drive.
Right. Right. And so you say that you were in high school with him. So you both liked magic and were performing at the time. Did you work together, or how was that?
Well, we weren't in the same high school. He went to Perrysburg High School, and I went to Adrian High School, and we met at a competition, a talent competition in Toledo, and Lori and I won, and Owen and Linda and I became fast friends from there on out.
Huh. And Owen passed away. He's not alive anymore. Is that right?
Owen Redwine? Oh,
yeah.
He's still alive.
Still alive. Who am I thinking of? There was somebody else, I believe, who was...
I think you're thinking of the guy in Tennessee who built all the zigzags for everybody.
Could be.
Owen Magic?
I believe that may be who I'm thinking of then, yes. So do you keep in contact then with Owen today?
Every once in a while. Once in a while.
Is he still building?
I don't think so, no.
Okay, does he really do much, if anything, in magic at all, any day, as far as you know?
Yeah, I don't know. He's doing mostly mechanical drawings for some engineering firm.
Yeah. Now, you work for an engineering firm. Weren't you an engineer? Is that right, after you got out of school? Or?
No, not an engineer. Right out of high school, I went to college, put myself through college with magic, and we toured the college market for 15 years, and then went into the corporate market. And also, at the same time, we developed a haunted house. We did that for 17 years. And then we closed that in 2011. And in 2008, when the market crashed, I went back to college, finished my degree, and went into the world of corporate
America.
Corporate world, yeah, corporate America. And so I languished in there for 10 years working for various companies. And for the last 5 years, I worked at Whirlpool, which is a great company to work for. Uh-huh. And during that period of time, I learned so much, so many different skills that I could apply to Magic through lean and continuous improvement, which are all quality and engineering tools. Then I applied those, and I tell you what, most people probably remember when I first reappeared in the Magic scene was 2014 at the Combined Convention in St. Louis.
Right, I was there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I competed, and it was a terrible act. It was only a few months old, and the only thing that was good about the act was the concept of the mirror. But the act was so bad, nobody probably even thought that the concept of the mirror was even a good idea anyway. And I just couldn't get my mind off of that mirror. I thought that there was something that I could pull out of that. And then Gene Anderson pulled me aside, and he said, I want to have a story. And so that was the challenge. And when I learned about lean and continuous improvement, it dawned on me that I could apply that to Magic. So I applied that to this routine. And in 3 years later, from being the laughingstock, in my mind, I thought I was the laughingstock.
No, sure, you were not.
I sometimes look at it as I face planted on stage.
You're just being hard on yourself, I think, as most performers are. Immediately after a show, it's like, oh, that was a horrible show. Speaking of Gene Anderson, that was what he used to say, is to record your shows, because that way you'll go back, just what you said, oh, that was a horrible show. Then you play it back, and you do hear some laughter and applause, and you think, well, that wasn't so bad. You play it a second time, well, that was darn good. It's just that when you're in the moment on stage, you don't recognize necessarily what's happening, and so you think that it was bad. So that's why it's good to record that. And that was a tip that Gene had given me a long time ago, too.
Oh yeah. Well, I will state my case that the act was bad. Because when I got off stage, Maury looked at me with these really scornful eyes and painful eyes, not upset with me, just like, what happened? And so 3 years later, though, after applying those engineering tools, the act swept the combined convention with 5 wins and People's Choice Award. And at the same year, I improved the act even further. And that's when I won Penn & Teller Fool Us. And then in November, the act has gone through 20-plus evolutions. And so in November, it went through another one. And it got second place in China at the World Performing Arts Competition.
You were competing against a lot of Asians who are really those who typically have been at the top of their game and winning a lot of awards, and you came in second there. That's amazing. Did you get a lot of feedback? Let me go back for just a moment. When you did not perform so well, you were not discouraged and didn't give up, but you just reinvented then the act to make it work, because you knew that there was something there. A lot of times afterwards that the judges have the opportunity to meet with the competitors to give them some feedback. So did you go into the room? Did you hear some ideas, or did you read the comments that were on the sheets? I used to be a judge from time to time. I just wrote copious notes on all those sheets.
I didn't get any feedback.
Really?
Yeah.
No, that was a combined convention, though, IBM SA.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I haven't been a judge in the combined. I've only been a judge in the, well, individual, either SAM or the IBM, but I haven't in the combined.
Yeah.
It's different.
Yeah, there's interesting things happened at the combined in St. Louis. That's where they call it the Korean tsunami. That's when Magic really changed at a hyper speed. Mm-hmm. All those beautiful acts that we saw were just mind blowing. So my act really became a small footnote that day. And it wasn't even worth talking about. It was just all about what we saw at the Koreans. It was like seeing 10 Lance Burtons, you know, all at once.
Right.
And you were just like, what? Could the next act be even better? Yes, it can. Just kept getting worse and worse. But then some shocking things happened in the second time. The thing that was interesting to me is I did get some feedback, but some of the feedback, and I don't know, I don't know if some judges are just too hard on people, but and sometimes you can take that judgment and work it to your advantage to dig even deeper. But there was one judge in particular that said that my act wasn't commercial at all. And I was really like, I couldn't understand why he said that. And he gave me low points because it wasn't commercial enough. And I'm like, well, the contests are not meant to be who is the most commercial act. It's kind of like gymnastics. Gymnastics is really not that. It's, you know, or figure skating. You know, you can't watch that and be non-objective. It's a subjective view. Mm-hmm. And is it commercial? You know, you can't ice skate everywhere and you can't do gymnastics everywhere. It's the same thing. You're doing magic on a completely different scale. And so I walked away from that conversation just shaking my head going, what isn't this person seeing? And I will tell you this, the competition act that I have has been the most commercially successful thing I've ever created. And I do it for corporations, and I've actually turned the act of the mirror into a corporate seminar.
How is that? You mean like as a speaker, after you finish that, then you start to explain what they meant as symbols?
Well, no. What I do is I break down the act exactly how I developed it. And I tell it in a really really cool story. It's sort of like a Rocky story. You know, it's like you defeated and you come back up and you're the comeback kid and then here you go. But in the corporate world, they are really in tune right now with lean and continuous improvement and 8D problem solving because the world is getting incredibly complex and we need to change our systems of how we handle people and how we handle data and how we handle customers and supply chain and manufacturing of goods from raw material to the finished material. All that has to be leaned out so that you're communicating with your supplier and your customer in the most direct manner.
So you also bring to bear some of the experience you had from Whirlpool, obviously.
Yeah. And I explain those tools in great detail, how I use them to create the act, how to perfect the act, and then how to implement it, and then how to dish it out to the audience in a way that it makes sense in it from a storytelling standpoint. And the corporate world is eating it up. They just love the idea that you can take lean principles, which are usually used in quality and control, and you can put that to something that you are passionate about. Nobody ever thought about doing that. And when I started putting this together, the National Convention for Six Sigma got a hold of me, and they wanted me to be one of their keynote speakers. And it went over so well, I got a letter from the director, and he said, in the last 20 years, nobody has scored as high as I have on exit polls because it was so relevant. And nobody thought that you could apply these techniques to something that you're passionate about, and in my case, magic. And that to me is kind of thinking outside the box of how what would be deemed uncommercial to being the most commercially productive thing I've ever done.
So when you perform that, I assume that you do the show first and then you go into the details here as far as your speaking engagements. So typically do you perform like a night before after dinner and then the next day as part of the conference being one of the speakers?
No.
How's that work?
It's part one session.
One thing. So while you're still in costume and everything and the things are still on stage, you come out of character.
Yep.
Huh.
Yeah. It's a real different way of doing a seminar because it's a learning seminar.
Yeah.
And
how long does it take? About 90 minutes?
Yep, 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be doing it for the Navy. I just sent the all the material to them today. So the Navy saw me at the national conference that I was just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, the Navy? Really? So that'll be for the Puget Sound Naval Shipyard.
Now, boy, congratulations on that.
Yeah, there's still a few more steps and a few more hoops we got to go through, but it's looking pretty good. So,
fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, going back, I guess there are several things kind of want to unpack over there and with the show and everything and what you were doing. But going back still to the college shows that you were doing, you were on the college circuit, you said, for what, 17 years or 7 or 17? What did you say?
15.
15 years. Okay. And in doing that, I assume you were with NACA and did the NACA shows and then were booked to do all the colleges and going through that same process?
Yeah, we started with NACA, and then we got picked up by Bob Kramer, and he was the largest booking agency for the college market, and we stayed with him for 6 or 7 years, and then we went back on our own, and then we went into the corporate trade shows and we really got tired of being on the road. I mean, we were on the road hard. And
how many days of the year would you say that you were not home?
Well, you're there during the college season. So the college season, you'd be 9 to 10 months. You would be hard on the road. We in 10 years we did 1,000 colleges, and we wanted to get off the road, so we decided to do a haunted house, and because we would always go to a haunted house in October in all corners of the country, and we thought we could do it better. And so we put together the haunting at the local fairgrounds in a 20,000 square foot barn, and it was a minor success for about 4 years, and then it just rocketed.
What was that? Why did it? What was the flip that got flipped there?
We just changed up our advertising and the market was just ready for it.
Gotcha.
Because prior to us entering the market, the market had already had about a 3-year head start, so everybody had their favorites, and when ours just got to a level where we were outpacing the competition as far as show quality, and the rumors just started gaining steam, and then we got a lot of press because of what we were doing, and we had a bigger cast than anybody else, and we actually created a school that we were pretty proud of. We created a makeup school and an acting school. So
yeah.
they had a 2-week period where we trained them in acting and doing their own makeup. And one of our actresses is one of the top makeup people in Hollywood now. And
wow.
Yeah. So
now what year would this have been approximately whenever you first opened it for the first 4 years? Not just okay, it's fairly successful, but when did you just open that? What, in the 80s, I assume, or 90s, or when was that?
96.
Okay.
96 through 2011.
I was wondering if that's about the time whenever that some of these little pop-up Halloween costume shops started showing up in the malls.
Yep, that's about the right period. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so there was, you had this building over there, and how many people during your peak season did you employ?
Anywhere between 7,000 and 10,000.
Wait a minute. I mean, did you employed, not as far as sold tickets to?
We employed about 50 people.
Okay. Wow. That's still a lot of people. And so you taught them how to apply makeup and then develop the character. And when the character, that is like jumping out to scare someone or rising up from a grave or something like that, or what?
Yeah. Yeah. We did. We called it the 10 second scare, and we borrowed it from a theater company that did a haunted house in Chicago. They did a seminar on that, and we just expanded on it. And then the other thing that we did that other haunts didn't do is that we had our actors trained by the fire department so that they understood.
For first aid?
What's that?
For first aid, you mean?
Well, not necessarily for first aid, but for crowd control in case of a crisis.
Oh, good point. Good idea.
Yeah. And we had hall monitors for first aid. And every once in a while, we would have the fire department because they loved the haunting. They absolutely loved it. And we loved the fire department. So we really created a nice relationship with them so that they understood we weren't putting on something that was not safe for the public. So they would come in and do snap inspections on the fly, and we let them go through, and they wouldn't see anything out of order. And every once in a while, they would call and say, "Can we work the back halls?" Sure, come on in.
Now, did you have a different kind of a haunt for people to walk through of different age groups so that after a certain point at night, these were for adults, like college age kids, and then before that it was more family friendly, or was it all the same?
We did a whole bunch of different ideas. We found that the haunt, splitting the ticket like that was too difficult because you would either become a haunted house for children or a haunted house for adults because it's under the same name, The Haunting. We had daylight tours, and they were okay. But one time we were helping the United Way out, and they were going to do something. And this was the first year we decided to do that. And they said, "For free, come on into The Haunting for the United Way and help support the United Way." And they thought it was only going to be like, 100 kids. Thousands showed up.
Oh, man.
And I told them, I said, "Are you sure you want to do this?" And they, "Oh, yeah, it'll be great for the community." And they said, "Never again." Never heard from me again. Like, you put the word free and a haunted house walkthrough and free candy, and you're gonna pay the price.
But were they the ones who were manning the building, or what? Why were, I mean, in other words, if it was your deal, your gig, I thought you would have all of your people, and they just said, "Hey, would you agree to do it free?" And so you had to handle it, or did you step away and then they handled it?
Oh no, we did it all.
So why were they? Why were they saying it didn't work out? Because as far as they're concerned, I mean, they're hands off.
Well, no, they had some people there. It's just that they didn't have enough because they were creating, because they also had a side event that they were doing. And so, because they were trying to piggyback with The Haunting, as my memory serves me right, is that they were piggybacking off of us, and because we were going to do those daylight tours, and when the word got out that they were going to give away candy to the little kiddies and all of that, and it was going to be a free event, I was like, okay.
It's interesting when you say, "as memory serves me," because it sounds like that's something you put out of your mind and don't want to remember.
Yeah, it came back in parts and pieces. And I remembered they had a separate event that they were piggybacking off of. And it was just, I remember them just coming to me with their eyes wide open going, "What is going on?" It's your fault.
Well, yeah, exactly.
We're free.
Free. Free candy. Something to do. Well, what was the season? When did you have this open? Just only during the month of October, or prior to that, a little after? What, or weekends? What?
The month of October.
Every day?
No, not every day. It'd be Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And occasionally, in some years, we would start out on a Wednesday. And some years we would go into the first weekend in November, and, you know, all that does is just make you greedy because it doesn't, you know, your audiences are smaller, but yeah.
Right. Well, leading up to that, obviously, you were saying that you had these classes and everything that you were teaching people how to do makeup and do the 10-second scare, et cetera. When did that begin? In other words, was this a year-long type of thing that you prepared for and then you had to tear down and store and then put back up? Or and was tell me a little bit about that.
That was the nightmare of it. We had...
No pun intended there.
Yeah. it was... See, it was on the fairgrounds. So the fairgrounds... their event is in July, and we wanted to start setting up as soon as the cows and the manure and everything was swept clean out of the barn. And oh, such fond memories.
Were you involved in cleaning up some of that?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh, boy.
You know, it's a big cement building, you know, and you're just, you know, power washing everything off. And it was, oh, God, what a nightmare. But we got it cleaned, and it was probably, and usually the prisoners came and cleaned it because we have a prison. And they would come, and when they came to clean, those were interesting days of conversation we would have with those guys.
Like what? Give me a story there.
Oh, just their attitude. They're just really good. You know, they're happy to be out of their jail cell, and you know, they're the trustees. Mm-hmm. Just I can't remember a specific conversation. I just remember going, whew. Yeah.
But they were telling you about why they had been interred.
No, they don't talk about that.
Oh, okay.
No, they just have their own, you know, their own cliques and, mm-hmm. you know.
And so just, when they're cleaning up, I guess they're just hanging with their own guys.
Yeah, but we're talking with them too. You know, every once in a while they'll say, hey, can I bum a pop off of you?
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, sure.
Yeah. But, and so when you're setting up the stuff, are they helping or you got a big crew?
No, so here's how it went. About the last part of August, we would start the load-in. And the load-in consisted of two semi-trailers that would be backed up to the barn. And we would unload those for about a day and a half, just to get the gear out. And then we would assemble every year it was a new show. So every year it was a new layout. And so we would assemble the show 1 4x8 sheet of wall at a time, screwing them together, screwing one together until we had this intricate maze that was took up probably 16,000-17,000 square feet.
Wow.
And then put all the electric in it. And so that took until, you know, until opening day, literally opening day, there's stuff that we're still working on. And so that's, you know, 3 months right there. And then it takes about another 2.5 weeks to tear it all down and put it back. And I remember days when we would open up, we would close the barn because it's cold in November, and we would be pulling everything apart, and we would open up the barn door, and there'd be 6 inches of snow on the ground. And we just look at each other, like, what? It was green grass when we came in here.
Have we been in here that long?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I could tell you all kinds of just weird weather stories that we had. And of course, stories about people, too. But it was a real... It was probably the hardest thing I've ever done and the most fun thing I've ever done. You know, and Lori loved it so much. And but it was just so exhausting because I would say the haunting is what took me out of magic. Because we would start 6 months in advance to get all the ducks in a line to make sure.
That's what I was going to say, backing up just a second. So kind of following that through, after you got that loaded in, set up, beginning at the end of August and then all through September and then doing it on the weekends in October, after Halloween, then take me from there. So you start the tear down and then for a few months in storing and then you're working on the next year. So tell me about how that progresses.
Well, when the show starts, when you're putting it together, you've got all kinds of people that are excited to help us out, you know, from people from previous years. So you got a crew of about 10 that are revolving around helping you out just for something to do. Mm-hmm. And it makes the job easier. When the show is over with, everybody is so exhausted.
They disappear.
They disappear, and it's just Lori and I. For the most part, every once in a while, somebody will come in. But for the most part, it's just two people disassembling that 16 to 17,000 square foot building that you tear down 4 feet at a time. Hmm. And it's exhausting. And then you have to load 600 4x8 panels of wall panels into these semi-trucks. And by the time you're done, your body doesn't work.
it's a young man's game. That sounds like for sure.
it's just too much. And then you spend, you know, a month of just recovery. And
but then you park those vans or the semi someplace for the year.
Yeah, the fairgrounds moved them because they're rented. And believe it or not, we still have them.
Wow.
The ship is still in there.
You can put that all together again. Put the band back together.
I think by the time that happens, those trailers will be rotten to the ground.
So you take a break, and then after you've kind of relaxed for a little bit, are you doing any – well, then you're getting into Christmas and holiday season. I assume you're doing magic shows then too, which exhausts you even further. So this come January, then you start to think about what we're going to be doing for October?
Yes, and usually in February was the big conference for the Halloween convention.
Yep, I've been to those.
Yeah, and so we would be attendees there, and I would also lecture there. Mm-hmm. And and so we would plan the year, do all of our purchasing, and then we would just wait with bated breath because we couldn't wait until we got the new stuff.
Right.
And then
did you know going into it what you were going to be doing? In other words, I know they have new stuff coming out each year whenever I've attended these. And then, of course, you hear the speakers and they talk about different ideas. My point is, do you go in there thinking, okay, well, we have a design for this coming year with it's going to be, I don't know, it's going to be space or it's going to be cowboys or something that's going to be different from last year. Or is it that you get there and you think, well, that's a good idea. And then you kind of buy stuff there and then kind of put it together?
Well, we didn't have that kind of a budget where we could say, I want that automated machine and I want that and I want that. We would just go and look around and go, yeah, that's cool. What we would normally buy it for was the temporary store that we had. So we would buy all the temporary, you know, souvenir items that people would buy.
Oh, you had you owned one of those pop-up stores. You rented one of those. Yeah, gotcha. Uh-huh. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And as far as buying new props for the show, we really didn't buy a whole lot of that at the convention just because it was really expensive. And we didn't find that anything mechanical really scared people. We found that people were better at doing that because they're unpredictable.
Yeah, good point. That's a very good point. Huh. So obviously that you kind of got away from that because you realized, well, we're not doing much magic and I'm focusing more on this part of entertainment. And then at some point you decided you wanted to get back into magic then again. But a couple months ago, I was talking with Jamie Salinas as my guest, and we were talking about the part-time pro, which was a term that was coined, again, going back to Gene Anderson, in which that someone who is performing part-time and earning money for it is performing as if they are a professional, but still having a day job that they're either taking time off or a vacation or the weekends or whatever. And were you doing that successfully for a period and then decided to eventually make that leap to full-time, which I think I know the answer to that, and then went back again and came. You want to explain that?
You mean while I was working as in? Yeah. Okay. So when I left to work for corporate America, I was still doing magic a little bit here, a little bit there, but it wasn't until I got the bug in my ear that I really wasn't happy, and it was getting increasingly more difficult to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like that feeling. And
because your mind was on magic instead of the job at hand.
Yeah, it was on that, but it was also just soul crushing for some reason. I just didn't understand how some managers treated people, and how some managers would be elevated in their career after treating people like absolute, you know, garbage,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and I just didn't understand. I couldn't understand that. And it also gave me an interesting perspective as a performer that when people are sitting in that audience, they are coming from a world that I never knew about until I took the plunge into working for other people. And it is humbling when you see a full audience out there. These people don't have a lot of time on their hands. They are stressed. They may or may not have had a good job review, or they may have had a bad day at work.
Mm-hmm.
But they're there to escape, which is so important. And I never viewed it that way. And my performances and my empathy for my audiences has completely changed because I have that perspective. But yeah, while I was at work, I just felt that pull of going back to a time in my life where I was really most happy, and that was when I first got started. And when I first got started, I was a competitive magician.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think a lot of people know this, but back in 82, I won the SAM and the gold medal, and not the IBM gold medal, but the SAM. I got the Ben Chavez trophy and the gold medal that comes with it. I guess I got a perfect score. I was in high school. I didn't.
Wow.
I didn't really know. And
that was with an illusion act?
No, that was with manipulation.
That's why I got the Chavez. Yeah, got it. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I remember Father Cyprian coming up to me and he couldn't find me because I was so ignorant of these contests that I was just like, I just came up and I did a show. And he goes, he saw me in the lobby and he said, I've been busting my ass trying to find you. You know, here's a collared Father Cyprian,
right.
What are you talking about? He says, you won everything. And I'm like,
wow.
What? And then my career took off from there. But I just remember that feeling that of
accomplishment, I guess.
Not even accomplishment, but creating.
Uh-huh.
I had to create that act. So I got the thought in my head, well, I don't want to compete at, you know, the club level. I don't want to compete at Abbott's. I don't want to compete. You know, I had to go through the levels of where was I going to get back into. And I was thinking, you know, it's got to be FISM. There's no more professional, you know, where you can hang your hat and say, you know, yep, I either competed in FISM or I did well in FISM or I placed in FISM.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a professional badge.
Just to have been there, sure.
Yeah. And so I thought, yep, that's what I got to pursue. That's the only thing that makes sense to me. So I took my old act out, my manipulation act, and started retuning it. And then I ran into this mirror idea, and then it took off from there. But it was during that time that I was just whittling away at this act that while I was at Whirlpool, it was when I won the SAM, when I won the combined convention, then my phone started ringing constantly. I was getting emails constantly. And then when I won Foolus, then everything changed. And I started getting, every convention that I've ever wanted to perform at, I got the call for. And I was even getting non-convention calls. I did a production show in Athens, Greece for 6,000 people a night for, 6 nights.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was it was the first time I was in an arena show, and it was just outstanding.
It'd be hard to go back to Whirlpool after something like that, back to work the next day after you've been performing and winning this, and you have these accolades, and you're going back and where people are treating you the way they were, as you said, people moving up and not really being good people.
Well, good people, bad people. I think that they're just people that are in a bad system creating bad people, you know.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
I've had so many terrible managers, I can't even count, but I had one that was fantastic, and we got along absolutely great, but in this one department I was in, we had 6 managers in 4 years. That's
Wow. Kind
of turnaround it was. And it was Wow. Just like, none of it made any sense to me. I was like, this is all wrong. Can't you guys see this?
Really?
Yeah. And I would be like that in meetings. I got to the point where I just didn't care. And they're like,
speak up.
Yeah. And they would be like, Stuart, tell us really how you feel. And I would tell them. And I'll never forget, we were in a quality meeting. And this is getting way off the beaten trail, but this is something that maybe people who are working in corporate America can understand. We were in a quality meeting, and they were going through all of these charts and graphs, and I'm going, And they said, oh, look at this dip right here. And I'm like, oh, the same dip. The same dip. Why are we still on this? It's like every week we talk about a dip. It's like a 2% dip. It's like, oh, we have to investigate that. We got to troubleshoot. We got to 8D it. We got to find out why. And during the meeting, I'm doing all these other, I was looking at the spreadsheet, and I said, okay, they're looking at data week to week. And then they were breaking it down day to day. And they were losing their minds over day to day.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, I want you guys to take a look at this chart here. I'm looking at the same data, and you guys are losing your minds over this drop. I said, but if you back out to a month, we're up 70%.
Yeah, look at the big picture.
How can you complain about that? I said, when you look at year to year, day to day, and I put it up and I said, look, they're identical almost. And I said, some of these dips are vacations. Have you thought of that? And they're like, oh. And that reminded me of a really good rule of thumb in magic. And I've told people about this. And I don't know if I refer to it in the meeting, but it's like, if you really want to fool somebody, you make them look closer. Because because they lose more vision the closer they get. And it's the same thing with doing these online shows. The closer you get to the camera, the more things you can do outside the camera range to reset, to do something, to put something in your hand. There's all kinds of things that can happen. And
so as magicians typically would say, the closer you look, the less you see.
Exactly. And that's what that was what was one of the aha moments I had in that meeting. It's like, you guys are looking too close. You're fooling yourselves.
Yeah, you're really not seeing the forest for the trees, quite literally.
Yeah, and the funny thing is that after I made that revelation to them, The group disbanded 2 weeks later. Because they found it was a waste of time.
You made a paradigm shift there. That's amazing. Well, going to, by the way, virtual online types of shows. So this is something else I want to talk about, is how that you completely reinvented your character as far as not doing the show where that you have done your award-winning act and everything. Oh, and I guess I should say, and you kind of threw in there just in passing, and you'd fool Penn and Teller. That was something, just real quickly, if you could tell that story about how that you had come in with one thing and then had to change it.
Oh, yeah. So when I was at the castle, I filmed my act and then I sent it to Fool Us, and I wasn't getting anywhere with them. And then I remember Johnny Thompson was one of the key players mm-hmm. in it. So I sent my video directly to him, and he forwarded a message, and he had me blind carbon copied in it. As a, that was such a sweet thing to do. And he said, we have to have him on the show. And I'm like, Lori, look at this.
Wow.
He's telling them yeah. to have me on the show. And I wasn't getting anywhere before. And Sean Farquhar also helped me out too. He said, you got to give him a backstory. You're not giving him a backstory. That's part of the hook. And I'm like, all right.
Just like America's Got Talent.
Yeah, you need that. You need that hook. So I get the call, but I get the call that I'm going to be on the show right when I had dismantled the current method that they liked.
Yeah.
And I had a theory, and I had a strong feeling about this theory. And I remember Lori saying, don't take apart the mirror. I said, I'm not going to take it apart, but trust me, this is the right thing to do. And it was, I couldn't go backward. I knew that I was so sure of this that, yeah, the mirror was, that old mirror technique was done. So I built this standalone mirror. And I got it all perfected. And the first time I tried it, it was like, what? Wow, that's pretty cool. So it was very, mm-hmm. very deceptive. And so I just mentioned it in passing in an email. It's like, yeah, I've improved the method and I'm real excited to be on the show. And that's all it was. I'm real excited to be on the show. I've improved the method and it's going to be great. And they said, what? You did what? No, you're, I'm sorry, you're off the show now. You can't change it. And I'm like, oh no.
Oops.
This is a big problem. So I videotaped the improvement and I showed it to them and they said, okay, you're back on. And that was about a week of nail biting. And mm-hmm. I was really, yeah, that was tough.
Because Johnny had said, I guess, at that point that, oh, this is good, and this probably has a better chance of fooling them than the other method.
Oh, the method that I had was not gonna fool them. It was a good method, but it wasn't the right method. But I was 99% sure that this method was so bold that they're not going to figure it out. And as it turns out, I was right. And the first time I ever performed that version, I remember Lori saying the day of in the hotel, she goes, you know, this will be the first time you've performed this live in front of an audience. And I'm like, oh no.
Well, no pressure, but thanks yeah. for bringing it up and reminding me.
So, yeah. And it turned out great, obviously.
Wow. Well, so then bringing it to date where we are then now with you doing these shows virtually and creating a whole new character, having really nothing to do with mirrors, but something to do with cryogenic freezing. So tell me about Richard Preston and working on Mars and the backstory and the legend on that.
Yeah. That's quite something. I went off on a real goose chase when the local theater, the Croswell, in my hometown of Adrian. They called me up and they said they want to film my show on stage and they're going to stream it. And I said, that's no different than television. What about something better than that? And I said, you need to have the show interactive for it to be really effective. And so I said, give me a week. So we thought really hard, and I saw a bunch of shows, and I watched a bunch of trailers, and I saw the same thing every single time. And it was just the same thing. And it was something that I needed to get all the data on what I was seeing. And so I couldn't put a finger on what it was. So I did what's called an 8D. And 8D is a problem-solving tool that you use to figure out a problem. And the first thing we had to do is make a problem statement of why aren't these shows connecting with me. It didn't mean that they were bad. I mean, we were all doing just whatever we knew how to do. We were just doing it online, but there was just something that wasn't connecting. So we had to figure out that statement. And the statement, I don't have my notes in front of me with what we did, but it was something of, in order for the problem with Zoom performance is that you have to have a connection with the audience.
Right. Just like you would in the real.
Yeah, because other than that, you're just, you know, showing off doing a trick.
You have to break that fourth wall, even online.
Yeah, and it goes even farther than that, and we added to that an emotional connection. Because just having a connection is one thing, but an emotional connection is completely different. So I said, okay, let's list all the tricks that we can find that will work. So we put post-it notes all over the living room, and we wrote down every trick that we owned and every trick that we think that would work. And we kept on coming around the same thing. It's like, it's really hard to put an emotional thing on this. It's really hard to put, like, B-Wave. How do you put an emotional spin on B-Wave?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And we were just coming up against a brick wall. And then one day it was just like, oh, we need some, what about a story? And we're like, yeah, but yeah, then you get into this really weird, we don't have a lot of time to write a really compelling story. We can get something else. What could we get? We don't want a theme, so we were working through all that. What if my character was a character? That's fine, okay, but the character's got to come from somewhere. And then we just stumbled upon Richard Preston. I don't know why I came up with Richard, but I know that Preston was kind of like Presto.
Presto, sure.
And so, like, say, Preston sounds magical, like Blackstone. Preston.
Like
and
rather regal.
Yeah, right. And so I was like, all right, so we've got the name. Now, how can we make this guy connect with the audience? I'm like, wow, I don't know. I don't want to copy anybody. That's the other thing. We don't want, because everybody looked the same. And that was part of the other problem, is that everybody was sitting at a table with their back up to a wall, and it was like, ugh, same thing.
Right.
Sitting at a table, back up against a wall, or just standing around, is just doing tricks. It just wasn't enough. So I thought, why don't we make him this character that nobody saw coming?
Almost, so, quite literally, yeah.
Yeah, and that you couldn't copy it. So we said, why don't we have him cryogenically frozen in 1962, and with the idea that he was supposed to be unthawed 100 years later to perform on the first colony on Mars. And that is the premise of the show, is that he was unthawed because the world needed him most right now to bring the world back together.
But he was frozen at the time when he was kind of at the peak of his, quote, powers and influence and popularity, because you've got pictures of him with Ed Sullivan and Nixon and everybody.
He was beloved. He was the most beloved entertainer in the world, and he needed to be preserved for future for future audiences.
To national treasure.
Yes. But at the same time, in 1962, the world was on the brink of nuclear war. And why, you know, we put seeds in these vaults in Antarctica, right?
Right.
Seed vaults. Well,
yes.
So he's sort of like that. He's one of our seed vaults. It's like you take him out when you absolutely need him.
And now is the time. We need him more than ever.
Yeah. And so I thought, okay, nobody's going to copy that. I mean, because we've got Mars, and we've got cryogenically frozen. But now I need to put him in history. And so we kept building ridiculousness on that. I have a picture of him signing his name in cement at Grumman's Chinese Theater. I've got him on the cover of Newsweek as a war hero, as a pilot in World War II with Ed Sullivan and training in the training fields in World War II. I even have him with Eisenhower and Theodore Roosevelt as a spy. Mm-hmm. Crazy.
Kind of reminds me a little bit then of Forrest Gump when he had, well, I'm going back to see the president again.
Yeah. If Forrest Gump and Austin Powers had a baby, it would have been Richard Preston.
There we go. That sums it up.
That's how I describe him to people, and instantly, boom, they understand that. So that follows a rule that I created that I discovered with The Unintentional Magician. And that is, you have to have something familiar to create a connection. And the connection that he had is that he's gone through all of these world events that were real world events that we put him in, and it's connecting with people. And it totally makes sense, and it solidifies him as a real person. And
when you're saying that it's connecting with, it's having resonance right now with people, even you said that you had just done a TED Talk also.
Yeah, I did. And the thing that is important about this character is that he's stronger than me, because he's of the World War II generation, the greatest generation, right? And what better person can you have than at your side is somebody that has been through everything, but they've been through all these wars, and now, you know, you need great leadership. You need somebody that you can guide you through the darkness.
And that's now is the time for Richard Preston.
Yeah. And that's who he is. And at the end of the show, he does this really cool thing that, He tells people, look, I've been through all of these things. You know, I do the Egyptian cotton,
Egyptian thread,
gypsy thread, and a lot of magicians use that as a little goodbye. And this is his goodbye. But every time he breaks the thread, he's like, I was born in the Great Depression, and then there was World War II, then there was Korean War, and then there was polio, and then there was Vietnam, and then there was nuclear holocaust, the possibility of nuclear holocaust, and if I can get through that, you can get through this. And that's how it ends.
Great.
And it's a leave behind that everybody talks about, and that's that connection, and people really talk about that, because the show, as wacky as it is, it has a powerful message at the end. I mean, really powerful. And it resonates with people, and it's what they remember. And that's where I wanted to go with this. I didn't want it to be tear jerky and it's like, oh, I'm really going to think hard on this and make it real, artsy. It's like, I don't have that capability. That's not in my wheelhouse. That's in other people's wheelhouses. but I do have the capability of creating something wacky and fun and enjoyable, but at the same time at the end where Richard can just sit, you know, bring it all back down and just do the one thing that we all are looking for is that it's all going to be okay. And that's what we...
That's the message. And that's good for any time in history, because we all go through perils, just like you were talking about in the early 1900s there, that we go through in the early 20s and we'll go through in the early 30s. I think that it's just what happens, certainly. And this is a character that you can also then take into the future as well and perform without having to haul around all your illusions and everything.
Oh, yeah. And that was the other thing that we wanted to do, is we wanted to create a show that primarily could be, for the most part, you could do live. And honestly, I think this character is a lot more fun to do than my own. Because
it's better to be somebody else. It's fun to be in character. Different people have different characters, and so they've got something else, so even they can come back to the same client to say, I did this for you last year and I've got something completely different than next year that we can do for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's good to have characters that you've developed and you've rounded this out. That sounds great. Well, what a full life. And you're still a young man and have a lot more yet to go, Stuart. I'm so proud to have you as a friend and so glad that you had the time to take out here to talk with us on the podcast here. Now, the name of my podcast, of course, is called The Magic Word. And so I always like to close by asking my guests what it is that your philosophy of life, what is your magic word or phrase?
Wow.
What do you live by? What's important? What's your philosophy? When you wake up in the morning, this is what gets you going.
Take action.
Ooh, that's the best one. I've not heard that one ever. Take action.
Yep.
That's true. A lot of times that we have the ideas, but unless you actually get up and do it. I remember C.J. Johnson one time in his lecture that he had a book and he said, this book is going to be for free. And he just kind of laid it down. And it wasn't until about 10 minutes later, someone stood up and walked to the front of the room and took it. And he said, that's the way you do it. You take action. You have to, you know, you're not going to get something unless you physically get up and do something. You have to take action.
Well, there's another side to taking action, is that if you take action, something else will be revealed to you.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Take action because something else will be revealed to you. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is great. Wow. That's something to ponder. Stuart, thank you so very much. Best to you and Lori, and I appreciate you being on here.
You're welcome. Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I mean, and thank you. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Stuart McDonald. This is Scotty out. Wow. Thank you so much, Stuart. This was really fantastic. A lot of really good advice and some real diamonds in there. Not just diamonds in the rough. I think those have been finely honed over time and under pressure, that you have created some beautiful things there. And I know that more things are to come in your future that will be very successful for you. So congratulations on what you've accomplished. And also, I hope that you, the listener, take these comments to heart and perhaps can apply some of these to your own life and to your profession then as well, to inspire you to be a better magician and perhaps to compete and get into contests and move your magic performances further as we move our art further then as well. I also want to remind you, of course, that you should go to themagicwordpodcast.com to this week's episode, number 588, where you can see some of the videos as well as some promotional photos of Stuart McDonald, and you can see him on Penn & Teller Fool Us and other videos then as well that I think give you a little bit of a background about what he has done, what he's developed, and some of the contests he's been in, etc. Anyhow, highly recommend that, as well as, of course, that he has his Richard Preston, the magician from the 60s who had been thawed out. He's doing that from time to time, and you need to perhaps just do a Google search and you can find out when the next virtual show might be that you can attend to watch him, which I highly recommend. Really a lot of fun. I've attended one of the shows and I have recommended it to many, and I think you would enjoy it. A very creative fella. And I also, at the first of the podcast, had mentioned something about the contest that we still have 1 week left to go, so be sure to sign up for that contest. I should say register to enter that contest. So this way that you can have a chance to win one of two books that are offered by Eileen Falls, which is No Ordinary Magic, which are her memoirs of traveling with the late great street magician Jim Cellini. I think that the two lucky winners are really going to enjoy that book. It's a very good read. Also, one last thing, and then we'll wrap up over here. I want to again thank the Friends of the Magic Word. Those are the ones who give their financial donations, and also many of them have gone out to iTunes and other places where they can leave their descriptions of how much they enjoy this podcast, as well as leaving a 5-star rating. And I just wanted to read one here that I had received recently from Steve Sabo, and he is a friend of the Magic Word. First of all, the title to his comments is Thank You for Wrapping Up Magic History in a Bottle. He says, I want you to know how much you are appreciated. Thank you for making your weekly podcast interesting and so enjoyable. I wake up every Thursday morning eager to download your latest podcast. You make the commute enjoyable. I will also listen to your archives. You have fabulous interviews with famous, not so famous, and now deceased magicians. You have wrapped magic history in a bottle for future generations of magicians. We who enjoy the art of magic, thank you. Happy holidays. And that was from Steve Sabo, and he also gave us a generous donation as a friend of the Magic Word to show his continuing support. So thank you, Steve, and thank you for the rest of you who are friends of the Magic Word who have financially supported us, and thank you again for all the listeners who have gone out. If you have been using Amazon to help us, appreciate that. If you have been leaving comments on iTunes or whatever podcast platform where you listen to this, I know that there are places where you can leave 5-star comments for us as well. So thank you guys very much for that. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to take action, because something else may be revealed to you. This is Scotty out.